And to this, Mr. Speaker, I say not only no, but hell no.
Without a fiscal plan in sight, the State House suddenly pulls its plan to tap the permanent fund. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, too close to call, no final tally yet on the vote to recall three Homer Assembly members.
And we have to find a way to understand each other a little better, because right now there isn't even any understanding going on.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska Southeast offers the Finnish College Alaska initiative, designed with flexible online learning options and customized degree programs. It's college that fits life, work, and play schedules while earning a degree. UAS is now offering a 3-credit tuition waiver for eligible applicants. Apply for the fall semester by Tuesday, August the 1st. Learn more at finnishcollege.alaska.edu. This message is sponsored by UAS.
The Alaska House voted to restore permanent fund dividends to the full amount of roughly $2,200 this fall. Alaska Public Media's Andrew Kitchenman has the story.
Anchorage Republican Representative Gabrielle Ledoux said during a floor session that she doesn't support cutting PFDs without requiring oil companies to pay more in taxes.
Without this amendment, we are headed to a budget which reduces the people's PFD. And to this, Mr. Speaker, I say not only no, but hell no, and urge you to vote with me.
By pushing the House capital budget further away from the Senate's, the vote may make it less likely the legislature will reach an overall budget deal before the end of the special session on Friday. And reaching a consensus is even less likely on a long-term plan to balance how much the state government spends with how much it raises. Both the House and Senate had previously voted to reduce PFDs as part of a plan to close the long-term gap. But the two bodies had different ideas on how much to take. The House would have made this year's PFD check $1,250, while the Senate voted to make it $1,000. But the House plan also includes higher taxes on the oil and gas industry, as well as an income tax. The Senate has rejected tying changes to the permanent fund to new taxes. Ledoux says having full PFDs would help residents.
Alaskans are facing economic hardships during this ongoing recession. Delivering a full PFD not only delivers to the people their full share of the economic wealth of this state, but it also keeps freezers running, oil tanks full, and food on the table, providing a much-needed economic boost to our state.
It's not clear if the PFD increase will receive support from the Senate. It's also not clear if it will be approved by Governor Bill Walker. He vetoed half of PFD money last year, cutting it from just over $2,000 to just over $1,000. Walker said in a statement that his administration is working with lawmakers to ensure government services continue after July 1st. Walker said, quote, "There will be actions that do not align with the full fiscal plan I proposed. In the coming days and weeks, if necessary, my team and I will continue to work with the House and Senate toward a compromise plan and passage of a budget," end quote. Fairbanks Republican Senate President Pete Kelly says the vote was a distraction from negotiations on the operating budget.
It's a kind of proof that they're very desperate to get an income tax. They do this through inflating the budget to the point that we almost have to have an income tax to fund it. I don't think it's much more complicated than that, but I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and continue to negotiate as long as we can.
The House voted 26-14 to include $1.5 billion for PFDs. The funding drew support from most members of both the largely Democratic majority coalition and the Republican minority. If there's no budget deal by Friday, Walker will likely call the legislature immediately back into a second special session. If there's no budget before July 1st, the state government will shut down. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The votes are all in for Homer's recall election of three Liberal city council members, but the results are not yet clear. The politically divided town will remain in limbo until absentee votes are counted on Friday. KBBI's Aaron Bolton has more on the unofficial results.
As the ballots came in Tuesday evening, it quickly became clear the election is too close to call. Just over 1,000 voters went to the polls to decide the fate of Homer City Council members Donna Adderhold, Catriona Reynolds, and David Lewis. The council members found themselves embroiled in controversy earlier this spring after sponsoring a failed resolution regarding inclusivity. Petitioners argue the council members intended to make Homer a sanctuary city, committing misconduct in office and economically damaging tourism. The three elected officials enjoyed a small victory after Tuesday's votes showed them slightly ahead, meaning they would keep their seats. Each council member is voted on individually, and the margins vary from about 80 to 30 votes, razor thin. Councilmember Lewis was happy the votes are in.
It feels good. You know, it's nice to hopefully have this whole thing over with, and we can get back to quote-unquote normal life. Whatever that's going to be now.
But there are more than 700 absentee ballots to count, along with several question ballots. Lewis hopes the absentee ballots will mirror the regular vote. Adderhold and Reynolds say they will wait and see. But Reynolds feels vindicated by the results.
I think that shows that half of the community, even if they didn't agree with what we were trying to do with the resolution, understood that that was just part of the day-to-day life of being city council member.
If the preliminary numbers are anything to go by, the results show a community split almost down the middle on the issue. And you could see that divide all over town on election day. Supporters and opponents of the recall gather about one block away from each other on Pioneer Avenue. Red Pro Recall signs sprouted up near a city park downtown, but one lone speck of blue stands out.
We had healthy discussion on this corner.
Yeah,
we're like Willie and the Poor Boys.
Alex Copland holds an anti-recall poster next to Coletta Walker, a recall supporter. As people drive by, some honk, wave, or give thumbs up or down.
We get more thumbs ups because they don't know whether it's him or us.
Yeah, that's true. We're getting a lot of thumbs
been
up
positive.
Because nobody quite knows because of the blue sign and the red sign.
And I'm saying just vote today.
Yeah, so. We want people to vote, but also we have our priorities too.
Right.
But yeah.
The vote has become a proxy battle for disputes about national politics. Larry Zaccaro is one of the sponsors of the recall petition. His sign reads, "You're fired," a nod to President Trump's catchphrase on the reality TV show The Apprentice. Zaccaro is one of the larger financial backers of Heartbeat of Homer, the pro-recall political action committee. He says he's very aware of the divisiveness fracturing the community, and he says he's looking forward to putting the issue behind him.
I didn't want to be in the newspaper. I don't want to be on the radio. I don't want my face all over the place. I've got the angry calls. I have people at work that won't talk to anymore. But when that resolution hit my inbox, there was no choice.
Chairman of Homer Citizens Against the Recall, Ron Keffer, and a handful of supporters gather down the street.
More free speech, vote no on the recall.
Both Keffer and Zaccaro share some common ground when it comes to how the community will handle the election results. Each agrees it may take a long time for anger to dissipate. Here's Keffer.
And we have to find a way to understand each other a little better, because right now there isn't even any understanding going on.
Absentee votes will be counted and the vote certified Friday afternoon. Until then, those dug in on both sides will just have to wait.
That was Aaron Bolton reporting from Homer. As you've probably heard by now, five people were shot this morning at a baseball diamond in Virginia, where a Republican team was practicing for the annual congressional baseball game. We asked our Washington correspondent, Liz Ruskin, to tell us what the day was like at the Capitol. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Lori.
So what was it like? What happened today?
It was kind of a sad afternoon. At noon, there was a House session, and everyone came. It looked like all the House members were there. And Speaker Ryan gave a pretty emotional or stirring speech, and there was a real sense of bipartisanship. And after that, the House canceled all their events, and so the hallways went kind of quiet. And the Senate went on as usual, but there were, they recognized several times in the committees and on the floor, people talked about the shooting.
Was any of the Alaska delegation affected?
Not directly. None of them is playing baseball in the game tomorrow. None of them were on the diamond. You know, it is kind of a community, a workplace, and somebody is bound to know someone. The spokesman for Senator Sullivan, Mike Anderson, he played basketball with one of the shooting victims. His name's Matt Micah, and he is the most seriously wounded. He's got a big wound to the chest, and he's in intensive care.
Does he work in the Capitol?
He's a lobbyist. I guess he used to be a staffer for several House members, and now he's a lobbyist for Tyson Foods.
And have you heard anything about what kind of shape he's in now?
Just that he's still in critical condition, that he's in intensive care, and his family expects him to be there for a few days.
Liz, how did the delegation react today?
Well, of course, they all said that they were thinking of the victims and praying for the victims of the shooting. And there was a lot of appreciation from the delegation and from the Capitol generally for the Capitol Police. Two Capitol Police officers were shot, and they returned fire. And if it weren't for them, many people said there would have been more casualties.
Did any of them, the senators or Congressman Young, express, are they worried about their safety?
No, I don't think so. I spoke to Senator Murkowski, and she said she's never felt personally, you know, unsafe. And she does walk to work most mornings that she's in Washington. She said she would not like to have a security detail like a few of the Congress members have. She said she didn't want to feel insulated from the public.
Liz, do you know if any of the Alaska delegation plans to go to the game tomorrow? The intention is to continue as scheduled.
Right. The game does go on. And Senator Murkowski said she just might go. I'm not sure about the others. And I actually bought my tickets today.
This is a fundraiser, this ball game, is it not?
Yes, it is. It's I believe it's a Boys and Girls Club. And they added another charity, the Association for Fallen Officers, I believe it's called.
All right, Liz, thanks so much for those details coming out of the Capitol today.
Thank you, Lori.
That was Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reporting from Washington. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, free weekend parking may be over in Anchorage.
From the agency's perspective, it's a limited resource, so we only have so many spaces available that are curbside in a downtown setting.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
The Early Honors Program at Alaska Pacific University delivers an experiential, individualized, and transformational education to high school seniors across Alaska. Find out more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
There's a battle brewing in Anchorage over parking. It centers on a new plan to start charging at parking meters during weekends. As Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, the debate is over whether the changes will drive business in or out of the area.
Ask pretty much anyone, and they'll tell you the same thing.
Nobody likes paying for parking.
Brian Borguno is the parking director for Anchorage's Community Development Authority, which controls about 6,000 parking spots in garages, lots, and curbside meters. For years, the price for parking on downtown streets stayed flat. Under the Berkowitz administration, the Development Authority studied whether those old prices and policies still made sense.
From the agency's perspective, it's a limited resource, so we only have so many spaces available that are curbside in a downtown setting.
When Borguno's team collected data and had it analyzed, the results showed that a third of the cars parked on Saturdays were squatting there all day long. And that means less customers circulating through businesses in the area. A stakeholder group made up of property owners, restaurants, stores, and others endorsed the idea of charging at meters on Saturdays. However, it is not politically popular to start demanding money for a resource that's been free, at least free on the weekends. But Borguno says it is not about collecting revenue. It's about boosting parking space turnover in front of businesses and pushing people to lots and garages if they plan on spending longer downtown.
When the on-street parking isn't being managed, it limits the economic opportunity for businesses to have more customers and the potential for people that are visiting downtown to have available space to park at the most convenient locations.
Less than a third of the downtown parking spots are at meters. Under the current plan, the city will start a pilot program on July 1st that issues warning tickets when people don't pay at two-hour meters on Saturdays between 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. Basically, pretty soon Saturday parking downtown will be just like any other weekday. And in August, those warning tickets will become real tickets. On top of last summer's increase in parking rates, this is not welcome news for Forrest Dunbar.
There was a very negative reaction from the public, including from me.
Dunbar is the Assembly's vice chair and represents communities on the east side of town, far from the business district downtown. He's introduced a proposal that would bar charging for metered parking during evenings, Sundays, or before noon on Saturdays. In filed documents, Dunbar says the start of metering on Saturdays could have a chilling effect that could significantly impact the economy of downtown businesses. This seems to be less focused on merchants than on restaurants and bars.
A lot of people come downtown, and then if they've had too much to drink, sometimes they'll leave their car and they'll take a cab home.
Dunbar thinks if people suspect they'll get a ticket for leaving a car parked overnight, then they're more likely to try driving home under the influence.
Now, the parking people will say, you know, we don't think that's the case. I think it's sort of common sense.
Dunbar says for people living in faraway neighborhoods, relying on cabs can be an expensive option. And he doesn't think those residents have been sufficiently consulted about parking fees. His ordinance leaves the door open for charging at curbside meters after noon on Saturdays as a compromise on the issue. Borguno, the parking director, says there are no studies or data backing up the claims that DUIs might increase. And he points out there are already limits on people parking along most downtown streets between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m., particularly during winter when there's overnight plowing. The issue is set to be discussed during a work session at City Hall on Thursday. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The former treasurer of an entertainment industry union that raked in money during Alaska's filmmaking boom is charged with stealing nearly $200,000 from the union. 62-year-old Anchorage resident Ann Redding is charged with embezzlement and forgery. Federal prosecutors say Redding has a court date set for later this month, but she is not in custody, and they refuse to comment on whether they know where to find her. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove has more.
During the heyday of Alaska's film tax credit program, union membership expanded at the local chapter of the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees. That means union dues also grew at IATSE Local 918, as it is called. Ann Redding had been with the organization since 2007 and handled the union's money during the state's brief movie and TV making boom. It was not until after the state's tax credits ended that the charges say Redding started stealing. That was in 2010, the charges say. In 2013, the union's checks for things like rent and utilities started bouncing.
You know, I was totally stunned. I'd never been involved in anything of this nature.
This is Richard Benavidez, the local union chapter president at the time. And his voice is a little messed up from medical treatment.
All this is going on, and we're having monthly meetings of the executive board and all of us sitting there. And this person is sitting there with you, you know, having this normal conversation with you. And you have no idea.
Benavidez says that during an audit later, he became aware of checks on which his signature was forged and saw some written on the union's account to people like Redding's mother, who lives out of state in a nursing home. Ultimately, the union realized its accounts had been wiped out. When the alleged crime became clear to Benavidez and the other union leadership, he asked Redding to resign.
I said, why would you even do this kind of thing? I don't understand this. I feel so betrayed. And she basically just said, you know, I don't know, Richard. I don't know what to tell you. I can't explain it. And, you know, she started to tear up, and she was obviously upset. You know, she never did tell me anything. She just basically told me that she didn't understand it herself.
According to court records, Redding was charged on Friday. She has a court date set for June 26th, and the court has issued her a summons. It is not uncommon for a person facing such charges to remain out of custody until a detention hearing. But when we asked the U.S. Attorney's Office, it was unclear if the authorities know where to find Redding in the event that she does not show up for court. When asked if law enforcement had served the summons or were actively looking for Redding, U.S. Attorney's Office spokeswoman Chloe Martin wrote in an email that, quote, our office has no further comment. We were also unable to reach Reddick herself for an interview. For Alaska Public Media, I'm Casey Grove.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in all the training programs, from accounting services to security and protective services. Tweet hashtag CareersBeginHere to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
The bodies of two fishermen missing from a western Alaska village have been recovered. Searchers on Tuesday found the bodies of 55-year-old Peter Nanook and 35-year-old Justin Nanook of Unalakleet near the mouth of the Gulsovia River, about 20 miles south of the village. Troopers in Nome on Sunday night received a report that the men were overdue from a fishing trip to Klickitarik. Searchers from St. Michael could not find the men on Monday. Volunteers in boats searched Tuesday and found Peter Nanook's boat swamped. Searchers a short time later spotted the bodies on the ocean beach near the river. The state medical examiner will conduct autopsies. The Coast Guard has suspended the search for a man and a boy missing on a boating trip out of the Bering Strait village of Wales. The 23-year-old man and 14-year-old boy launched a wooden rowboat at 2 a.m. on Sunday. They were not wearing life jackets. A half hour later, village residents heard the boaters calling for help. A village volunteer search and rescue group searched the shoreline but did not find the boaters. Coast Guard air crews from Kodiak and the crew of the Sakuliak, a University of Alaska research vessel, joined the search. The Coast Guard says its crews covered more than 2,300 square miles. Wales is 111 miles northwest of Nome. A sewer replacement project in Sitka has turned up more evidence that one of Alaska's oldest cities has been inhabited for a long, long time. A stone tool resembling a wedge or striker was unearthed in an excavation beneath a street in downtown Sitka and may never have been found, but for a retired anthropologist who knew what to look for. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Like the stone artifact itself, this story may never have seen the light of day without a Jeff Davis Street resident who called police about a woman with a small shovel digging in people's yards. The culprit proved to be Nancy Yaw Davis, who grew up on this corner.
When I was about seventh grade, I had a pet deer called Fritzen. It was a fawn that had been rescued and brought to Dad, and he brought it to me, and we kept it alive for a while until the dog got it right on this corner.
Less than a stone's throw from the place where we're standing are petroglyphs, prehistoric rock carvings of unknown age and origin, right in the middle of downtown Sitka. So many people have lived, grown old, and made their own memories on this spot. For an anthropologist, finding a stone tool was almost unavoidable.
My line is, I came looking for my childhood marbles, and I really lost them that morning when I found this.
The object itself resembles a modern wood splitting maul or wedge, except it's got three faces instead of four. One end is squared off where you might hit it with another stone.
When they're flat on the top, that allows a platform then for flaking off and using or pounding, I think. But you know, intelligent guessing is what we're all capable of. But whether or not we can prove how it was made or what it was used for, I don't know. That's far beyond what I know from looking at a rock.
And it does look like a rock. The artifact is nondescript to the untrained eye. I would have walked right by it. Davis noticed it because it was a different type of stone than the gray wacky gravel piled all around this road project. Just a block away is the Sheldon Jackson Museum, and it's got a small collection of stone tools, some of which resemble the one Davis has discovered. Curator Jackie Hamburg thinks it might have had a utilitarian purpose.
And that particular one looks to me more like it's a striker, that you would use that to work other stone objects in order to create your tools.
Archaeology is not always what people imagine it is. Indiana Jones exploring an ancient cobweb temple. A lot happens out here on construction sites, but not this one. Although Nancy Yaw-Davis has worked as a contract archaeologist for a similar project just a few blocks away, the state doesn't think one is necessary this time. Judy Bittner, head of the State Historic Preservation Office, says the soils under street projects are often too disturbed to allow for careful archaeology, where everything around the artifact, known as context, is just as important as the object itself.
And if it's just sort of random artifacts or bottles and things that were part of the, detritus of the living population there, and you know what to expect, and you already have information from it, and you're not really going to gain new information about that settlement or the occupation or that time period in history.
Davis knows this as well as anyone, but she's still a little bit irked. She sees artifacts almost everywhere she goes and believes there is an important human story literally beneath our feet. Objects like this stone striker, though useless to archaeology in the strict sense, represent a cultural richness that modern society doesn't seem to fully appreciate.
And I think we should assume that there were people here throughout this magnificent area and that there is evidence of them if we learn together how to recognize it.
And she wouldn't mind if the field of archaeology were a little less territorial.
And it's just a highly select, small group of people that have the privilege of being archaeologists. They're more general anthropologists, and I think we have more fun because we see a larger picture, a different picture.
Archaeologists have more fun.
I think they drink more beer than the rest of us know.
Yet another reason for Sitkins living near major sewer projects to keep the police on speed dial. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Aaron Bolton in Homer, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, and Zachariah Hughes and Casey Grove in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you're one of the 120,000 Alaskans with some college but no degree, the Finnish College Alaska Initiative at the University of Alaska Southeast offers a degree program with flexible online learning and a personalized degree plan. UAS is now offering a 3-credit tuition waiver for eligible applicants. Apply for the fall semester by Tuesday, August 1st. Learn more at finnishcollege.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.